everybody, and welcome back to the Chilluminati podcast, episode 325. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Mike Martin, joined today by literally who else did you expect? It's Jesse and Alex.
I like a nice square number, like 325.
I didn't expect us.
Yeah. You didn't?
You thought you weren't going to be here today?
I was counting on nothing happening.
Today, maybe that you might feel like that after sitting through this episode. I'll tell you that much.
Yeah, but that's not promising to any of us.
No, this is good. I like this episode. I want to go on the record. Today's episode, I'm running with it. First of all, patreon.com/Chilluminati Pod. What a website, right? Before we even get started, we wouldn't even be here without it.
No, that is actually literally true. Without Patreon, we wouldn't be doing this like we are able to
if you want to support us, go over there. I'm going to be able to, at this point, talk about way more stuff that's going to be on the Patreon soon. We're going to be kind of doing a little nice little coat of paint on the Patreon. Nothing's really like major going to be different.
Nothing's
really
taken away or anything.
It's just going to feel good. And that's what I'm excited about. So go over there. Get
I don't know what that fucking means. Go over to Patreon and find out.
It's just gonna feel good.
Go over there.
Almost threatening.
Yeah, it's gonna be just what the doctor.
It's gonna feel so good when you're over there.
So nice.
So good.
No, go there. Check that out. There's nothing else to promote right now. You can still, I think, go buy the stickers. Top secret stickers, guys. We support artists 50-50 split. We pay them for their time and then we split the profits. Yeah. That's what it should be when you're an artist. Imagine that. Go there, get it, buy it. It's secret stickers from a episode of the author's choice, the creator's choice. And it's a great sort of tangible way that the ideas that we write here on this show can become real. And speaking of that, today is amazing because I did not plan it this way, but the topic of today's episode has for some time been a topic that I've wanted to cover. Ever since shortly after we started the show and I started to realize like exactly how weird the shit that we cover here could be.
We cover
looking at you,
anything.
Andrew WK, looking at you. but originally, I was going to do JFK part 4 today, which was going to be like my best guess.
You're never getting it, listener.
the twist of it this time around, though, since now that I've told that horrible story of JFK's assassination, like, to tens of thousands of people multiple times. I was going to write it as like prose fiction. That was like going to be the plan. I was going to like write like a story that was like completely prose and I was going to have us like read it. But the whole point of it was going to be, it was going to be clever because like without really saying it, I was going to be kind of saying that even though the event of his assassination is not fictional, any retelling of it kind of fundamentally is fictional because there's like so many.
Well, now you're spoiling the whole thing.
Well, it's so many conflicting versions of the story create a fictional version. And so for all intents and purposes, the fictional versions of the story that have been written have kind of replaced the factual version, especially when lots and lots of people read it, like the movie JFK, which I spent a lot of time discrediting earlier. But then the reality of writing a 1 hour long short story about Lee Harvey Oswald kind of settled into my brain. Felt pretty daunting, especially after I wrote that entire Victorian thing, which I feel like I felt like I wrote a short story. That was like a really long process, longer than I normally take to write an episode. And then I also realized that the iconic American novelist Don DeLillo's own fictionalized book on the subject of the JFK assassination, which is called Libra, already made the point basically that I was making. I've even quoted it before in the JFK episodes. And he did it way better than I could hope to. The dude wrote White Noise. So I threw out Kennedy with the bathwater, at least for now. I might come back to it in some other form later. But I decided to focus only
him
on
and
the
his
part
missing
instead.
Brain and skull piece.
It's done. He's dead. We already know we're not going to get
we
it
fucked
figured
that skull
out.
Dry,
there's been
dude.
Like three different presidents that were like, I'm going to tell everybody everything. And then they like, don't, like, it's fucked. Like, fuck it. The fucking thing. Everybody was like, oh, new JFK stuff. Literally nothing happened.
There were no more juices to squeeze, dude.
The best theory so far is the one where the dude on the other car shot him. That's the best I can say. That's the one that feels the
no
most
one said brain worm yet, and I feel like that is a possibility. Same brain worm, two different
genetics.
Generational yerks.
Yeah.
Yeah. That brainworm has been taking out Kennedys for 60 years.
Almost like Animorphs became real.
Does that make RFK the hero? Because he's still technically alive.
No, I'm not going to say that.
No, I won't say that. Speaking of throwing out Kennedy, I throw out Kennedy with the bathwater. And I'm not focusing on Kennedy anymore, but I am still going to focus on the part about the relationship between reality and fiction, which is how I came to the Philip experiment, which, as Mathis briefly explained last week, was a study about whether or not your own thoughts can create reality, right? The thing is, though, what I thought was weird was I don't think I told anyone I was doing an episode involving the Philip experiment.
No.
And so you brought it up completely randomly. If you're listening to this show in order, as close as possible to this, to me talking about it right now, the last thing that you talked about in the episode, which I had to cut you off literally was the Philip experiment. So what is the Philip experiment?
May I tangent momentarily?
Yeah.
And just say, like, the reason that I even got into the Philip experiment is because the past two episodes of the alien abduction episodes, like, I just kind of went on this research tangent of, like, if you were to take it at face value and say it happened, regardless of whether it's tangible or not, what would be the logical reason, like, they have totally different personal experiences with very similar looking creatures?
Yeah, like, at a aesthetically time where it wasn't, similar. Yeah,
like, in some similar thing. And the Philip experiment ended up coming through that way because of that research. And that's how I got there. And I wanted to bring it up with you on a phone call we had that Monday. And I was just like, you know what? It's like totally off topic. I'll not worry about it now. I'll bring it up in the episode because that's where I wanted to wrap the episode. And you were and the fact that you're like, that's next week blew my mind. I was it's very surprised.
Exactly. It's very much like a Rashomon type thing. You know what I mean? Like that idea of the same story being told by five different people and it's like got a different tone and a different art style and a different, all that. Like it's the same thing. But anyway, this episode's called Chilluminati. It writes itself.
Thank you so much to Cash App for sponsoring today's episode. And let me tell you, if you're looking for a really easy and fast way to be able to send money, receive money, and all kinds of stuff, then Cash App is the way to go. Seriously, it is a game changer. I love how convenient it is to just send and receive money. Plus, the Cash App card, it's not like just a card, it's a whole thing. You can even personalize it. I've been thinking about what I'd put on mine, and I don't know, I'm not super creative, so like an alien, probably. Is that normal? Cash App is more than just a safe way to send and receive money. With the Cash App card, you get tons of perks without hidden fees. Things like early access to concert pre-sales, like Kendrick Lamar and Sabrina Carpenter, plus discounts on everyday purchases at brands you're probably already spending money on. It also keeps your money safe by automatically flagging suspicious transactions and letting you lock your card instantly if it's ever lost or stolen. For a limited time, new Cash App customers can earn $10 if they use code CASHAPP10 in their profile at sign up and send $5 to a friend within 2 weeks, 14 days. Terms apply. Cash App is a financial services platform, not a bank. Banking services provided by Cash App Bank Partner. Prepaid debit cards are issued by Sutton Bank and member FDIC. Discounts and promotions are provided by Cash App, a Block Inc. brand. Visit Cash App Legal Podcast for full disclosure. What are you waiting for? Download Cash App today by using the link in the description and pinned to the comment below. Trust me, it's gonna love you. It's gonna love it. Thank you, Cash App. Yeah,
thank you, Cash App. Basically, back in the 70s, as a way of trying to explain hauntings and poltergeists and the weird sounds and things that happen at seances and stuff like that, researchers from the Toronto Society for Psychical Research, under this guy, Dr. A.R.G. Owen, which I realize is a hilarious slightly confusing name for a real man.
Owen.
Yeah. Especially in an episode that I wrote.
Into whether this is a real story or like Alex made up one.
Yeah.
You mean like A period R period G?
Yes.
Like,
okay, Dr. A.R.G. Owen. Yeah. Not like ARG. His name is A.R.G. He prefers A.R.G., which is, this is not an A.R.G. He is just a man called A.R.G. He decided they were going to get a group of eight people together. No psychics, no mediums, just normies. And have them create the story of a fake person who is completely just made up for the experiment. Like the act of creation happens during the study. So they're going to do that and then just see after that if they could figure out some way to make actual contact with that person, that fake person. So that's crazy, but that is what they set out to do. The group included Dr. Owen's wife, Miss A.R.G. Owen, who was a former Mensa chair, if that means anything to you. But also other people from all different walks of life, from a student to a housewife to a career industrial designer. And on top of that, there was also this guy, a psychologist, Dr. Joel Witten, who was also there to like observe and make sure that it was like not just like some weird ghost hunter gassing people up or something. And yeah, it's literally exactly job. What I said. It's literally, it went down exactly how I said. They all got together. They wrote the biography of some fully fictional dude that they invented. His name was Philip Aylesford. They sketched him, like got like an idea of how he looked, and became intimately as familiar with his story as possible. And now Jesse is going to read you the bio of this man.
Philip was an aristocratic Englishman living in the middle 1600s at the time of Oliver Cromwell. He had been a supporter of the king and was a Catholic. He was married to a beautiful but cold and frigid wife. Do we know? Damn. Am I making assumptions about poor Dorothea here?
This is all fake. This is a fake guy. They just all made right, all this shit is, up.
You yeah. know, all right.
This is more about the storytellers than it does about yep. Dorothea.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, no, no. This has the exact same vibe. Now that I'm remembering that this is all made up, it has the same vibe as, remember that, like, when Chuck Schumer was like, I made up a family that lives
yes.
in... Like,
yes, yes.
Same the vibe. Voting Democratic family.
Yes, yes. And it's like, what are you talking about, you madman? Same thing here. It's like, the wealthy sure do have a lot of free time.
Beautiful, but cold and frigid. That's like, yeah. That's like a porn character. Let's be
honest.
Right,
anyway, his wife was cold and frigid, Dorothea, the daughter of a neighboring nobleman. One day, when out riding on the boundaries of his estate, Philip came across a gypsy encampment and saw there a beautiful, dark-eyed girl, raven-haired gypsy, Margot, and fell instantly in love with her. He brought her back secretly to live in the gatehouse near the stables of Diddington Manor.
Dude, that's
a real place. Home.
You never want to go to Diddington Manor.
Diddington Town.
Diddleton Manor.
Feelington Square.
Yes. For some time, he kept his love nest secret. But eventually, Dorothea, realizing he was keeping someone else there, found Margot and accused her of witchcraft and stealing her husband. Philip was too scared of losing his reputation and his possessions to protest at the trial of Margot, and she was convicted of witchcraft and burned at the stake. Philip was subsequently stricken with remorse at that he had not tried to defend Margot and used the pace of battlements of Diddington in despair.
He used to pace the battlements.
Ah, yeah. Used to. Finally, one morning, his body was found at the bottom of the battlements, whence he had cast himself in a fit of agony and remorse. Look!
Yeah,
they had those a dark fun. Hair girls are trouble. Those yeah, that a, dark they hair, had a, that like,
they had a little fun.
She got the little like, oh, she do the dance. I've seen Esmeralda, dude. That yeah. man
oh, dude,
was willing
yeah.
to burn in hell for her.
That's
he
fair,
was like,
though.
I'm old and I went to church and I don't give a shit. I want some of that.
It's
I
fire.
I get
hell
it.
Fire. The neighboring
every
noble.
Man in France was like, damn, yeah, I get
brutal.
It.
It's brutal. But yeah, if it feels built out, that's because it was, right. Because starting in September of 1972, they just started having these like sittings where they would just like sit around and talk about Philip and affirm things about him and kind of spin little tales of things he would do and be like, and talk about how he looks. And they would like reflect on other things they talked about with him. And just
I've never
really
been in one of these, but would you like say like a writer's room almost of like,
it's
a
like a writer's
ideas,
room, but it's
like
even
yes
more like
and everything.
It's like, it's almost like a writer's room for like a eulogy or something. Like you're really talking sure. about him, his life. Like, let's talk about Philip again. Like, where were we at? Oh yeah. His like his job. Okay. Like, let's go back. Like, why did he want this job? You know, they just like kind of built him up.
Yeah.
Over time. They refer to him as some sort world of quote, building. Some, yeah, Philip building and some sort of quote, because it's not a world. It's just Philip. Right. And on purpose, a lot of the facts contradict history because that helps them verify that the answers to the questions that they ask him about his life are coming from him. You know what I mean? Because if he says specific
well,
wrong things,
it, but I can't remember if it's them that do the experiment after, or if it's other people that don't.
It's them. It's them.
See, that, but, yeah, yeah, okay.
But we'll get into it. We'll get into it. So they start having these sittings. They call it a, quote, collective hallucination. They're fleshing out. They're encouraging him. And when I say collective hallucination, I meant that this went on for years.
Hmm.
Until all these people knew Philip that they made up intimately and extremely well. Like, it was like a hobby of theirs, just thinking about this guy, Philip, that isn't real. And sometimes in these sittings, they would almost feel like he was near, like he was somewhere around. But they never approached anything resembling like communication with a fictional character, if you know what I'm saying. So eventually, as like a Hail Mary pass, they decided to try like an actual straight up candlelit seance. And they dim the lights and they like put up pictures. If you remember when we were talking about Grant Morrison and how they put up John Lennon and listen to John Lennon music, it's very reminiscent of that. Like
the opening pages pictures, of the Invisibles as well.
Yeah, pictures that reminded them of Philip's castle and of Philip, little objects Diddington. That Philip might have in around Diddleton, sang songs from the period that Philip was from. And eventually, one night, after watching something that they couldn't see slide the table around the room on a carpeted floor, they all agreed that they were now able to directly communicate with Philip through a sort of like knock once for yes, knock twice for no system on that table. They actually talked to him enough that they started to feel like he was actually responding to them in a way that made sense to them.
The not real person.
Philip. Correct.
Yeah, like a ghost, yes.
So but, the whole time, keep in mind, this is not a real person. They made him up.
Yes.
Actively made him up
but
for years.
But he's dead-ish no, in their story.
He's long dead.
He's yes. long dead right. in their story, yeah.
And it's a seance. So they asked him if he's Philip. He says, yes, I'm Philip. They asked him about his life, his preferences. They even said he could knock like hesitantly or aggressively with emotion to like be like, yes, yes. Or like, maybe. You know, like he got to that point. And
intonate your knocks for me, ghost.
Yes. And it gave them a sense of something like his personality in what was happening. And he would happily answer questions a lot. And here is a quote from Mathis to read from Stephen Wagner at liveabout.com about how those sessions went. Okay.
Yeah.
So here we go.
That Philip was a creation of the group's collective imagination was evident in his limitations. Although he could accurately answer questions about events and people of his time period, it did not appear to be information that the group was unaware of. In other words, Philip's responses were coming from their subconscious, their own minds. Some members thought they were heard whispers in response to questions, but no voice was ever captured on tape. Philip's psychokinetic powers, however, were amazing and completely unexplained. If the group asked Philip to dim the lights, they would dim instantly. When asked to restore the lights, he would oblige. The table around which the group sat was almost always the focal point of peculiar phenomena. After feeling a cool breeze blow across the table, they asked Philip if he could cause it to start and stop at will. He could, and he did. The group noticed that the table itself felt different to the touch whenever Philip was present, having a subtle electric or quote-unquote alive quality. On a few occasions, a fine mist formed over the center of the table. Most astonishing, the group reported that the table would sometimes be so animated that it would rush over to meet latecomers to the session or even trap members in the corner of the room. The climax of the experiment was a seance conducted before a live audience of 50 people. The session was also filmed as part of a television documentary. Fortunately, Philip was not stage shy and performed above expectations. Besides table rappings, other noises around the room, and making lights blink off and on, the group actually attained a full levitation of the table. It rose only a half inch above the floor, but this incredible feat was witnessed by the group and the film crew. Unfortunately, the dim lighting prevented the levitation from being captured on the film. Although the Philip experiment gave the Owen group far more than they ever imagined possible, it was never able to attain one of their original goals, to have the spirit of Philip actually materialize.
Yes. And did I find that television broadcast? Yes, I did. It's there. It's in the show notes for you if you want to look at it.
Yeah, we'll pop it in the notes.
Yeah. And obviously, the results were so satisfying and confounding to them that they tried this same idea a few more times. They made a French Canadian spy that they called Lilith, which again, rich people do get up to some stuff. And another time with the medieval alchemist Sebastian. And one time, even Axel, man of the future, appeared and communicated directly with the group. So, first things first, question for the group. What could possibly be the cause of this? Like, is it our subconscious mind? Is it somebody straight up lying? Is it somebody being messed with?
Both, right? Like the TV show, immediately the thing I noticed about the TV show is it has camera edits, it has cuts, it's like very much produced, so there's plenty of opportunity to fuck around with it. And there's been plenty of ghost hunting shows that have supposedly never done it, been caught doing, you know, funky shit in edit or what have you. So it's very easy to say it's a lie. And even I'm not even saying that to be like, oh, if you think it's a lie, it's not true. I think it's probably like faked, like for the most part. Like, I don't know. I'm trying to think what the reason would be, but they got to be on TV. Like, so that must, you know, that alone could have been like their driving factor for just faking it.
Sometimes it's just fun to, I mean, this is, you know, this is, they could be D&Ding it, you know?
Almost D&D. Yeah, it's almost D&D. But
I love this because it also has the hallmarks of like, whatever you believe you can imprint on this. So you could say, the collective combined powers of their consciousness have unlocked something that created a or you could say a demon is using this as a way to get to, like, no matter what you believe,
the demon could be pretending to be them. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's, this is very interesting. It's not where I thought we were going.
Or I like it. It could even be something along the lines of like the ideometer effect of like when you do Ouija board, you don't feel like you're moving it, but the ideometer effect is your subconscious is moving it. You look at any other weird situation, a poltergeist that seems to have no motive, or even Jeff the Mongoose, right? You look at him. Is if this is, to take it at face value, real, the imprinting of consciousness warping or like reacting or subtly changing itself to be real, quote unquote, in a way, even if it's not real in history, is fascinating. It's the collective unconscious and manipulation of reality on an information level. What's maybe Jeff the Mongoose was only Jeff the Mongoose because that's what they thought they were dealing with. And so it slowly became that. Or maybe that's why the aliens themselves are always a weird personal kind of trippy experience for these people. It's
exactly.
It's all kind of, you can throw it all under the umbrella. Maybe that's why people see Bigfoot, but there's no evidence of Bigfoot because we're the collective unconscious believes enough that it's enough to show up, but there's never like there enough because they're not really real.
Take it in a direction I was not going, but
if you were to take it as real, right? Like if you were to take the perspective
just look at Mathis's last two episodes through this lens and you can start to see how it applies to those things. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can start to see how the alien is interpreted as like a God type Christian type thing. And then it's, you know, and then it becomes something else.
And the simple fact of why aliens physical forms in abduction encounter scenarios change over time. In early on, before they were little gray men, they were like weird hairy monkey people in spacesuits, and they slowly changed.
Exactly. And they used to, I remember I was listening to like a bunch of like alien themed stuff because I was putting together that hokey Halloween song playlist, and like a big part of Martian lore back in the day seems to be that they talked like absolute like gibberish, exactly. And like that's just like not part of it anymore, but it like was. It's like interesting. I don't know, really weird.
It's a lot. So much. It's a rabbit hole that doesn't end is the issue. Like, well, it just,
we're gonna see how far down it we can go today, so don't you worry, this is not the end of where we're going with this. But that's why I'm asking the second question now, which is, do you think this has ever happened elsewhere outside of a lab? Like, if we're going to talk about fictional stuff appearing in real life, it can't all just be in a controlled lab type setting, right? Like, if you believe this is true, right? So to answer that question, we need to talk about another paranormal researcher besides Mr. ARG Owen called Hans Holzer.
Phenomenal name.
Yeah. So like before BuzzFeed Unsolved or Zach Bagans or Taps,
the Ghost Bros.
Yeah, or
that was my OG. Yeah. That's what I originally, because they were from fucking Rhode Island, dude. They were from my
everyone
kind of
remembers
state.
Taps back in the day. Mine was
Most Haunted with Derek Acora and Yvette Fielding. But before all of them, there was this guy in the 60s and 70s called Hans Holzer. And reality shows weren't really a thing yet, and I'm not trying to get too far into the evolution of TV-based ghost hunting and stuff like that. I feel like that could be an episode in and of itself. But instead of that, the vibe was more like he wrote books and claimed to have psychic abilities and would go on like the news or like a late night show or a variety show, talk show type thing, and do like tricks, like appearances and like little, you can imagine exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But really, I think if you look into him further, which one of us probably will do at some point, he's like the OG ghost hunter in the way that we see them now. You'll see a lot of the imagery and the aesthetic and the style and the flavor that ghost hunting has as a hobby today can be traced back to Hans Holzer and him being the guy that first got the word out by like writing books and going on TV about that this thing exists. Like he took it from being like a hobby that some people had to being like a thing that was ready to be a reality show in like a couple of years, like in 20 years, you know what I mean? Which is pretty crazy. But it doesn't have that much to do with why we're talking about him today. The real reason that we're talking about him today has to do with a specific case that he was investigating in May of 1963 in New York City in a three-story Greenwich Village brick building located at number 12 Gay Street. Ha 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 ha.
Where he and his, again.
Yeah, oh my God. It's called the street. You don't want to know what the name of this street is, guys.
You're gonna be so messed up
when you hear it. Where he and his favorite so Hans Holzer and Betty Ritter, who is his like psychic assistant, like researcher person, were listening to Frank and Ted, who are the two puppeteers that live in this building and put on professional quality puppet shows in the basement theater that they have on the premises. Frank and Ted were telling Hans and a couple friends that they had invited over that they had been noticing strange little things here and there for the past 7 years that they'd lived there, that they'd performed their puppet shows there, but only recently had things gotten completely bizarre. So here's a quote about it for Jesse to read for a book by Hans Holzer, which has the best name of any book I've ever heard. It's called Yankee Ghosts. Here you go.
I walked over to where the gray-haired little lady sat, who had been introduced to me as Miss Hall. "Oh, there is a ghost here, all right," she volunteered. It was in February 1963, and I happened to be in the house, since the boys and I are good friends. I was sitting here, in this very spot, relaxing and casually looking toward the entrance door through which you just came, the one that leads the hallway and the stairs. There was a man there, wearing evening clothes and an Inverness cape. I saw him quite plainly. I guess Inverness?
It's like this very specific type of cape that you'll, if you look it up, you'll be like, oh, those motherfuckers.
He had dark hair. It was dusk and there was still some light outside. What did you do? I turned my head to tell Frank Paris about the stranger, and that instant he was gone like a puff of smoke. Paris broke in. I questioned her about this since I didn't really believe it, but a week later, at dawn this time, I saw the ghost myself, exactly as Alice described him.
That was Alice who was voicing before? Great.
Miss Hill, yeah.
That's Miss Hill. Wearing evening clothes, a cape, hat, and his face somewhat obscured by the shadows of the hallway. Both Alice and I are sure he was a youngish man and had sparkling eyes. What's more, our dog also saw the intruder. He went up to the ghost friendly-like, as if to greet him. These are the facts of the case.
So yeah, this apparition and a bunch of other weird stuff these guys experienced, and the fact that Hans Holzer had written up this story in his book as a piece called The Ghost of Gay Street in Yankee Ghosts, kind of led to the house getting a reputation for being like a famous haunted house. And Betty Ritter, the psychic, was able to connect some of the names and events that she'd gotten from her psychic impressions of the place to figures from the house's actual history. But this strange youngish man with sparkling eyes and evening clothes and an Inverness cape remained a total mystery until almost 10 years later in 1975, when Will Murray, he was writing for one of the two issues of his pulp fanzine Duende, which is real. You can look it up. Links in the description. Was hanging out at a comic convention in New York, and he scored an interview with none other than Walter B. Gibson, who is a writer who wrote the brunt of the stories published under the pen name Maxwell Grant, which was used by the authors of The Shadow, pulp magazine stories from the 1930s to the late 1960s. Do you guys know what that is, The Shadow?
Oh, Shadow Knows.
Shadow Knows?
Yeah, like didn't they, make, didn't they also movie? Make like a terrible movie based on that?
Baldwin movie, yeah, from the 90s.
Terrible? Yeah,
it's not terrible. Okay, maybe.
It's when they had The Shadow, and then they had the other one
Dick
that
Tracy,
was...
Rocketeer, all that shit.
Yeah, who was the one to bring it back?
Like Nielsen played the bandaged guy.
In Dick Tracy?
Was it? No, wasn't it a superhero movie as well that he played?
No, you're thinking of Darkman.
Darkman, that's what I was thinking of.
Dark City, right? Darkman.
I don't know.
I'm so messed up. It doesn't matter. You know what the Shadow is? He's like he's kind of like Batman, but he's not really a full superhero.
He wears a fedora.
He has like a mask. His eyes kind of sparkle. He's not really a superhero though. He just is like a guy. Even though in like the movies and the radio shit, he kind of is a superhero. Like he can like use the Force pretty much. He like do all
he
the
trained
things
that, in the Himalayas.
Yeah, he can change people's minds and shit and like read their minds. But
good for him.
Yeah, so that's the
good for him.
And he has a millionaire alter ego just like Bruce Wayne.
Of course.
And here's Mathis.
You're gonna see that fashion of like rich man buys his way to superherodom ever go away?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I think that people are really gonna be fucking pissed at rich people for the next 10-15 years. I can't imagine why though.
I wonder how they're gonna deal with Bruce Wayne.
Bruce Wayne is chill, man. He's not actually like true. All those criticisms of him are valid from like the 70s, but he's like a real guy. Anyway, here is the quote from Walter B. Gibson that was captured at a New York Comic Con by this fanzine. This is a quote from Mathis.
I remember talking with Ed Burkholder. He and I had an apartment together down in the Village for a couple of years. That's the apartment that's supposed to be haunted now. 12 Gay Street. I don't know why I said it like an incomplete sentence. 12 Gay Street. Hans Holzer said it's haunted. People see a man in evening clothes moving in and out. But that was where I wrote The Last Shadow. And what they're seeing is a Lamont Cranston. They're seeing what we call an after image psychic projection, not a ghost.
Yeah. So Lamont Cranston is in the movie, I think, in the radio. That's really who the Shadow is. Is he just like Bruce Wayne? But in the stories, Lamont Cranston is like yet another of the Shadow's alter egos.
gotcha.
But one of them is a millionaire. So Gibson also said he did not believe in ghosts, but that he did believe in psychic abilities. And that's when he read how Holzer had described the figure in his story. And he realized he literally recognized it as his own mental image of Lamont Cranston. And the Inverness cape, the look, if you look up what an Inverness cape is, it's like, oh yeah, of course. It's like a rich boy cape. It's cute. Yeah, but here's another quote from Mathis from the same
rich man's cape. That's a rich.
It's almost like you want to call it a Sherlock Holmes.
I was literally gonna say it's what you would think of Sherlock Holmes wearing during like a winter night outside.
It's like
what
the movie version would wear in like an inaccurate.
It definitely has a like. I put it across my face to God from the wind.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So here's another quote from Mathis from Will Murray again, the guy who did the interview, after he went looking into Gibson's term that he used, after image projection, and which is also going to act as a perfect bridge for us to this next segment. So here we go.
Thank you so much to today's sponsor, Hero Forge. I love these guys so much. I love working with these guys so much. And our promo code has changed. I'm going to put that right at the top. I used to just be chill. It is now ChillPod, all one word, ChillPod for the promo code moving here on out for the rest of the year. With Hero Forge. If you love Hero Forge, if you play TTRPGs or you love just minis and all that stuff and making your own mini, Hero Forge is where you want to go. You can go to Hero Forge right now at heroforge.com and for free, literally just digitally model the character you want. If you're playing in a tabletop game or if you're like me and DM a ton of different tabletop games, Hero Forge is a godsend. Being able to just design a couple of custom like goblins, for instance, and then just mass print them, or I have a 3D printer at home, so just buying the file and then printing the figures at home to use in my games is just invaluable. I love using them. Even before we worked with them, I was using Hero Forge constantly, which is why I'm like an avid supporter of these guys. And right now they have Black Friday sales going on that ends on December 31st, 2025. The sales are 20% off of physical miniatures and accessories, which includes color plastic miniatures, 3D printed dice, acrylic keychains, color statuettes, color standees, premium plastic, regular plastic, bronze, and steel. 50% off digital miniatures, which is the STL files and digital miniatures for VTTs. Obviously, all this stuff is subject to change and or cancellation without notice, not combinable with offers or promotions, not valid on gift cards, subscriptions, or digital credits. And again, the sale ends on the 1st of December. But just go check them out, man. Like, I love Hero Forge so much. There's a story in every roll. You like that? That's pretty good, right? Hero Forge 3D printed custom dice, 20% off now through December 1st, thanks to their Black Friday sale. Get 20% off of all the physical miniatures and accessories. Get 50% off digital miniatures and use code CHILLPOD at the end. Thank you again to Hero Forge for sponsoring today's episode. In the lore of Tibet, this type of manifestation is called a tulpa. Reputedly, a tulpa is an unintentional byproduct of a powerfully conceived idea. Whether or not this phantom Cranston could be termed a takua by the time that Walter Gibson had written that last Shadow novel, The Whispering Eyes, summer 1949, he had put it in over 16 nearly continuous years writing The Shadow. Certainly ample time to generate a tulpa if the human mind were capable of such a feat. Even Lester Dent, creator of pulp scientist adventure Doc Savage, is supposed to have claimed that he actually saw his characters walking around after a particularly intense period of writing. Who knows?
Right.
I find that fascinating because I think you're probably, I don't know if you're going to talk about it. I assume you will, but the idea of Constantine.
Oh, we're getting into it.
Yeah.
So, in fact, tulpas are not from the lore of Tibet, really, as Mr. Murray puts it. And also, you don't have to capitalize tulpa like I keep doing, because I keep thinking it's Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is like fucking me up every
it's really
single
close.
Time. But it is a Tibetan term, and it's basically been applied to more Western concepts that are like more like theosophical, metaphysics type stuff. And if that doesn't make sense, here's Jesse with a quote from a research note from Natasha L. Michaels and Joseph P. Laycock, which is a great last name, called Tracking the Tulpa, which is from Volume 19 of Nova Religio, the Journal of Alternative and Emergent Religions. Here we go.
Since the 1970s, tulpas have been a feature of Western paranormal lore. In contemporary paranormal discourse, a tulpa is a being that begins in the imagination, but acquires a tangible reality and sentience. Tulpas are created either through a deliberate act of individual will, or unintentionally, from the thoughts of numerous people. The tulpa was first described by Alexandra David Neal in his 1929 book, Magic and Mystery in Tibet, and is still regarded as a Tibetan concept. However, the idea of the tulpa is more indebted to theosophy than Tibetan Buddhism. Philological and archival evidence suggests that the encounter between Tibetan Buddhism and theosophy. Involving both Western Orientalists and their Asian informants, and translators shifted the meaning of certain Buddhist terms and concepts. As a result, concepts of emanations found in Mahayana Buddhism came to resemble theosophical metaphysics, as well as Western tropes of creations run amok found in such stories as Golem Legend and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It appears that many of the core features of the tulpa are, like Slender Man, the product of Western paranormal folklore. Thank God that's what that said in the end, because I'm one of those people who's like, tulpa sounds like made up bullshit. But I love the idea of the cross contamination of ideas from languages, and it leads to something that's fascinating.
The idea is that there is something similar-ish to what we think of as a tulpa in Tibetan, lore, as he called it. But theosophy, which, by the way, is like stuff like Annie Besant's Thought Forms from 1905, and I know Mathis still wants to do a Blavatsky episode later. So let's just say the main rub of it all can sort of be oversimplified into the simple but like interesting phrase, thoughts are things, which in this book literally means things which are produced by a specific thinker and which take on various color forms and sharpnesses and stuff based on abstract things like the quality of a thought or the nature of a thought, and which can take the form of the thinker themselves, like me imagining myself doing something or something, material objects, or most frighteningly, forms all their own. But that's as far as I'm going to get into that, because let's just say that thanks to actual experts who've looked into it, most people talking about tulpas are talking about the kind you're probably more familiar with, and we've talked about the show on the show before several times, which is just like you think about something enough that it becomes real.
And think it's hard, yeah, it becomes real in some way.
It's kind of like we heard about the Tibetan thing and like schmooshed it into something more like this theosophical thing, and kind of also made it into pop culture, which is kind of interesting. So here's Jesse with another quote from that same research note, this time about tulpas in more modern times, to kind of show you what I mean about how these ideas can evolve. Here we go.
The concept of the tulpa continues to evolve and adopt other influences. An online community of tulpamancers has emerged among individuals who feel they have relationships with tulpas they have created. In his online study of 166 tulpamancers, far too many tulpamancers, located mostly in the U.S. and Western Europe, psychiatrist Samuel Vessier?
I'll take it.
Vessier?
Yeah. Vessier?
Phenomenal job.
Vessier. Concluded that most are male, 17 and 34 years old, really need a girlfriend, and decide to make their own. I mean, who score high on psychological indices of shyness. The tulpas in the study functioned much like imaginary friends, providing their creators with companionship. And a significant subset of the tulpamancers also identified as bronies, male fans of My Little Pony, reporting that their tulpas appeared to them as anthropomorphic ponies.
Dude, I learned about tulpas in 2001, 2002 from a forum. Shout out RPG Palace, RPGP. Hey, where it was like that shit. People, where it was like 13 or 14 year old boys who were lonely talking about like creating tulpas of like, not of bronies at that time, but just like whatever. Like I can't even think of anything specific because I didn't have the patience.
It's
kind of
like an imaginary friend that you design. If you want to think about
and
it.
And then
way.
Eventually supposedly takes on a will of its own and
becomes
and then they love me
to you. Yeah. And then they love you me forever. Yeah.
So if tulpamancers are to be understood as people who interact with tulpas, in their own mind, like imaginary friends,
but what are you doing in your time off? I'm a tulpamancer. You wouldn't understand.
I know. But if tulpamancers can theoretically make them so real without even trying to sometimes that other people can see them, then let me ask you this. If those people Hans Holzer spoke to really did see Lamont Cranston in that apartment because Walter Gibson generated a tulpa of him in his mind when he wrote the Last Shadow novel, does that really sound all that different from the way writers talk about characters in their own heads, like normally and all the time?
If this is real, partly because that's where he wrote about it, but partly because it's been in the public mind and how many years of him publishing about it that the subconscious in that area or whatever would know about it. Yeah, no, it's not that different. I just tulpamancers. I hate the name. It's so stupid.
I don't write that much like straight up fiction in my life, right? I have, but you know, I don't do it that often. But I do kind of recognize this feeling that people talk about of characters writing themselves that some writers say they have. And I've definitely heard and read of other writers talking about that personally, right? Have you guys ever had anything like that? Or you guys have heard like writers talking about how the characters sometimes take on a mind of their own for sure, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
was kind of like, as I'm writing, I'm thinking, what will this character do? And then I'm surprised that, the character I've created would definitely like, in my mind, I'm not thinking it's like a movie where the person's sitting there and then they look up and their character's like, well, I would never do that. And you're like, what a fun movie. Like, this sounds like.
I think I've actively do that in like Vampire. Like a lot of the time, like whatever NPC, especially if a players are going to make it an important one that was meant to be there. There's a lot just on the fly that I'm like, well, this character's kind of taking the steering wheel for right now. here's the basic outline. Let my brain just run on autopilot of whatever this character may or may not do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I have a quote here from the novelist John Fowle's book, The French Lieutenant's Woman. It's like a really famous book, which, by the way, happens to be a book pretending to be set in the 19th century. To illustrate exactly what I mean, here's a quote. I'm going to read it. You may think novelists always have fixed plans to which they work so that the future predicted by chapter one is always inexorably the actuality of chapter 13. We novelists know a world is an organism, not a machine. We also know that a genuinely created world must be independent of its creator. A planned world, a world that fully reveals its planning, is a dead world. It is only when our characters and events begin to disobey us that they begin to live. When Charles left Sarah on her cliff edge, I ordered him to walk straight back to Lynn Regis, but he did not. He gratuitously turned and went down to the dairy. Oh, but you say, come on. What I really mean is that the idea crossed my mind as I wrote that it might be more clever to have him stop and drink milk and meet Sarah again. That is certainly one explanation of what happened, but I can only report, and I am the most reliable witness, that the idea seemed to me to come clearly from Charles, not myself.
I resonate with that super, super. It's very much like David Lynch, I think, is one that said it, where it feels like
fishing,
reaching into a river and fishing for an idea.
Your brain fish.
Yeah, your brain fish. But with like saying it, like the world becomes its own. I say it all the time talking to Jess or whoever, especially with the vampire world in my head. It very much feels like I just kind of turn my vision over and look at the world and watch what happens. And I just kind of narrate what the NPCs are doing. It's more like I'm observing, and it doesn't feel like work in that way. And it kind of feels like cheating a lot of the time, because it really does feel like a living thing that I just kind of like look at and then turn into, and I just narrate what I'm seeing to the best of my ability.
Right. Mm. Exactly. And the reason I bring this up is that a bunch of actual researchers, not like paranormal researchers, but like Durham University, you know, like not unaccredited.
We're paranormal researchers at this point in our lives, you know?
Like, look,
I mean, technically anyone can be. So it's not that cool.
My point is that the Philip experiment was carried out under less than ideal circumstances, where if it was in a
control group or any of that,
in a college, it would probably be better, right? But in this case, I'm talking about Durham University in Durham, collaborated with the Edinburgh International Book Festival to conduct a survey of as many of the hundreds of writers who were there, of various backgrounds and levels of professional success as writers, you know, people who write as a hobby, people who are very, very published and read, as part of a study on the idea of characters taking on a life of their own in a writer's head. And they ended up with some pretty interesting stats about how various writers experience this feeling across all kinds of different criteria. But today we're going to focus specifically on the notion of fictional characters exhibiting their own agency in writers' minds. You know what agency is, listener? The general you? It means
being able to
like do things yourself. That's what agency means. Do things, you know, do your own things. That's what agency means. For example, 61% of the writers in their sample reported their characters actually literally exhibiting their own agency. And as you might expect, 26% of that 61% said that that only happened past a certain point in the writing process where it's like been developed, and 22% said it happened only sometimes and not always when they wrote their characters. Like, it wasn't like, you know, once you pass a threshold, it's there. It's just like something that happens to them sometimes. Here's some anonymous quotes from two different participants in the study for Mathis to read, which I thought were kind of interesting to that effect.
First one, To begin with, they feel under my control, and then at that certain point when they feel completely real, it becomes a matter of me following them, hoping to steer.
Which is an imagery that you literally just used a second ago, which is crazy.
It's wild to actually like read other quotes like this, because like I don't write books, but I do a lot of active narration and world building and stuff, and it is to a point where just you becomes a point of itself drives, and I don't have to do anything, and it's bizarre.
Right.
The other quote is, I nowadays just plan my books halfway, as I know that in the middle of the writing process, the characters will take over the story, so my planning will become useless anyway. Yeah, I fucking feel that too. Like, that's a big lesson I learned between my first campaign and the second one, was like the ending went nowhere originally how I had first wanted to plan it. And I couldn't have asked for a better ending than the way it went, because there's no way I could build a better ending than what the players and stuff we all created. But it is... I love it. I love that my brain is like that. It's often a superpower that I feel like I forget that I, you can just have that imagination that just drives itself, it's given enough attention and care.
Yeah. Pretty fucking amazing stuff. Like the stuff, like the sort of processing power, like the environment that your brain can sustain that's so different from reality is very crazy.
Comes at the cost of everything else.
Yeah. Also, something I thought was kind of neat was that it didn't really seem, based off the responses from the people who said it happened infrequently, it didn't seem like the development of the character or the story was necessary for agency to manifest. Like, it wasn't something that they ever felt in control of as it happened or while it was happening, and it wasn't all the time or whatever. It was kind of like organic, you know, like what life is like. Like, life finds a way, right? So here's Jesse with two more quotes about all that. From some of these writers.
I'd love to pick at like George R. R. Martin's Ian brain Malcolm. To see if he has, does he have the ghosts of the characters he's written, like George R. R. Martin, if he like has shit like this happen to him.
I bet you they have. And
I think most authors write from a place of, I have it all planned. They don't plan it like that. They have a thing they want to do, and then their characters, a good writer will let their character be, you know, you put yourself in the character and you just go.
You land differently than you intend. It's like a gym routine is how I think about it. It's like, you know what you're going to do. Like, you know, like what you're what the story is. Usually when you start writing a story, there's a reason why you wrote it, but it never fully resembles, I mean, any piece of art or even cooking. Like, you can't control everything that happens when you cook. Anyway. Yeah. Go ahead.
My characters can often swing the story in an unpredictable direction. Depending on the story, I can either rein them in or let them run with it. I love it when my characters go off script. It's one of my favorite parts of being a writer, and often these unexpected plot twists are the best of all.
Yeah, pretty crazy. And of course, for that least common type of people who did feel like their characters had full agency at all times with no variability, which was the not at all small when you think about it number of 13% of the people that they interviewed. Often suggested that while the situations and settings and the style of the writing and things like that were never out of their own hands, the character themselves literally never was in their hands. And here's Mathis with another anonymous quote from that study about that specific topic.
My characters need to feel separate for me to hear their voices, which also means that when I'm trying to put words in their mouth instead of listening, they often talk back. And then we discuss things until I find out what they would say. If I'm really stuck on the emotional transitions in the story, then listening to what the characters want to say is extremely important. I write in a way that's equivalent to method acting. I have to be the character before I know what to write, and before I can listen to them as separate people in my head. They definitely act of their own accord, and it's usually best to let them. Plotting for me is as much about finding out how my book people get from A to B as deciding what I want the story to be about at the level of X happens and then Y. This is where a lot of surprises in my work come from.
It's almost like a movie where I look up and I ask the character if they do it and they say yes or no.
Yes, right? It's literally like, it's the way I build characters at this point too, where I'll just build them with core values and like a general history of what like, and why they are the way they are.
Right.
And then that's it. I don't script anymore. Even if they have to give a monologue or I want, like, you know, that shit is just in the moment, completely on the emotions of them and how the players are interacting with them and causing emotional recoil.
But of course, that's not to say there weren't outliers. So for the sake of transparency and completeness, here's Jesse with one last set of quotes that probably embodies the thing a lot of you skeptics out there are probably screaming at the speakers right now. So here we go.
The characters are frames, sets of priorities and emotions with, if you like, narrative vectors. Those vectors, in collision with external events and other characters, must be engineered to produce the story I want to tell. Sometimes the emergent pattern will take precedence over the plan. Other times we will rework characters to push the narrative in the right direction. I find the whole thing of my character just took over a bit cringy, to be honest. But then I am more of a plotter, so I like to know where I'm going with the character. However, you can intend one thing, then find when you actually create the scene or circumstance that your greater knowledge of the character suggests something better, more in keeping.
Yeah.
Interesting two quotes, because the first one just says, I don't believe in it. Here's what I do. It's the same thing. And they just worded it in a way where it's just you see different brains think and create differently. They just think differently.
And that right there is my little piece on fictional characters and how they might also in some sense might be real. And of course, again, this is only it gets easier when you allow the idea that creating things and doing magic are just two ways of describing the same thing. But what if it were literally real too, right? That's what you want me to talk about, you listener, right? You want me to talk about real fictional character, real accounts of fictional characters walking around in the real world and not just
Pony.
Not just in the movies, not just in the like in the movie version where you look up in your imagination and they're in there telling you what to do. Real. Because of course, as we in the Chilluminati know, ideas are one thing, but there is no better evidence. There is no better way to convince. Indeed, there is no better source than what? That's right. A somewhat credible primary source. So your boy grabbed his fountain pen, loaded up his pneumatic tube, and I put in a request for some examples of anything like this that we have kicking around in our agency archives. And the best part is, I just heard back from them yesterday. So, ladies and gentlemen, and anyone else I may have missed, please let me introduce to you the second half of today's program, which I received in a binder called Notable Cases of Possible Fictional Incursion from the archives of the Chilluminati Department of True Creation. Which I did not know that existed before this. And this is the first time I'm having a look at this live on air with you guys. But oh my gosh, look.
That's
look, there's a note attached. Oh my gosh. There's a note attached from, oh my gosh, it's from fucking A. Whitney Brown. Remember him? No? You will. No. It's okay. Crendor read a bunch of things as him.
A lot of things Crendor does, I forget.
It's for Mathis.
Okay. Fuck you, Agent Fasciani. Told you I was right about all this make-em-ups shit. Here, I saw your request in the system. Have some of this shit to read to everybody. I'm not at story group anymore. I've been enlightened, and now it's been a while. Let's just say I have a higher clearance and leave it there, okay? See you never. Thanks for doing that Ong's hat thing I wanted, though. Looking forward to it. Shit and piss. We're all one thing, kid. Agent Brown.
That guy is weird. Anyway, yeah, it looks really like weird. There's a bunch of cases here that he's got for us. And weirdly, I think he like labeled which one of us should read each of these little accounts here. So I guess this first one is for Jesse, and it's called Doug Mensch and Brutus the Ape. Kind of weird. Kind of interesting. Here we go. Oh, wait. There's like a little bit more. It's like a slight. When it says, should you give? It's just this last little sentence here. Here you go.
It appears that the paranormal often needs the pop culture form to appear at all. The truth needs the trick. The fact, the fantasy. It is almost as if the left brain will not let the right brain speak, which it can't anyway, since language is generally a left brain function. So the right brain turns to image and story to say what it has to say, without saying it. Consider how back in the late 1970s, the prolific comic book writer Doug Mensch writing out the real in a work of fantasy a few seconds before it became the real, in fact. I sat down with Doug in spring of 2009.
Different. 2009.
Oh,
no, dude.
The aughts. Aught nine. Here's the story he told me. Mensch had just finished writing a scene for Planet of the Apes comic book about a black hooded gorilla named Brutus. The scene involved Brutus invading the human hero's home, where he grabbed the man's mate by the neck and held a gun to her head in order to manipulate the hero. Just as Doug finished the scene, he heard his wife call for him in an odd sort of way from the living room across the house. He got up, walked the length of the house, and entered the living room, only to encounter a man in a black hood with one arm around his wife's neck and the other holding a gun to her head. It was exactly what I had written. It was so immediate in relation to the writing and such an exact duplicate of what I had written that it had become an instant altered state. The air in the room congealed, became almost fog-like, and yet, paradoxically, I could see the with greater clarity. I could see the individual threads of his black hood. Doug's emotional response to this series of events was a very understandable and natural one. He became obsessed with the black-hooded intruder for months, then years. More immediately, he found it very difficult to write. So terrified was he of that eerie connection between what he might write and what might happen. It really does make you wonder. Are you seeing the future? Are you creating a reality? Should you give up writing forever after something like this happens? I don't know.
A little piece of paper fell out while you were reading that. That's actually from Mutants and Mystics by Jeffrey J. Cripple. Science fiction, superhero comics, and the paranormal. A little book from the University of Chicago Press. Really good book. Pretty fucking crazy story, right?
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine? Can you imagine how that would... He said an instant altered state. Can you imagine how fucking weird that would be?
I would feel like I might be like react like the writer would, where I would be afraid to write for a while, even if it was entire coincidence, like which very well could be. Like, even if that's the case, I would still be afraid to write because the odds of that are so fucking low of like that happening that it humans grasp for patterns and meaning, right? Even if there isn't any. And that would be, I'd be like, I don't want to write. I don't want to write. I don't know what it's going to do.
Fucking nuts. Up next, we have a story about Dave McKean. Do you guys know who that is?
Dave McKean sounds like a familiar name, but
he's a comic book artist. He's really like kind of prolific and famous. He did the art for Grant Morrison's comic book Arkham Asylum, a Serious House on Serious Earth. And he's famous mostly for being the cover artist, very unique cover artist for Neil Gaiman's Sandman. It's like very almost like physical photography based covers. I don't even know what I'm talking about. Like really, they're really trippy looking. He did like almost every cover of, I think, the whole series. But what I have here for you, it looks like from Agent Brown, is a transcript from CBR.com of a moment from the 25th anniversary panel for Sandman that Dave McKean was on, which was the last time that he saw Neil Gaiman, by the way, which was in 2014, just so you guys know. And he was on with legendary comic book writer who recently disgraced for some heinous acts, Neil Gaiman. It was about Sandman. And like I said, In that book, Sandman is a member of the Endless, which is like a sort of like immortal group of concepts personified that represent things in our lives,
like despair and
that kind Sandman of stuff. Sandman is dreams, and he's dream of the Endless, and then there's Death of the Endless, who is this like cute punky goth girl version of Death. And here's a quote from that for Mathis to read. Here you go.
McKean then recalled flying to San Diego years ago when someone dies on his plane. And as they were waiting to board the plane again, he say a girl dressed as Death walked by him off the plane. The difference between you and I is I would have gone maybe? Question mark? Guyman said. The fundamental difference, McKean deadpanned as the room cracked up. I don't know if I understand what
So Neil Gaiman is saying, the difference between you and me, Dave, is that when I go on a plane when somebody dies and I see somebody walking off the plane who looks exactly like my character, Death, who I wrote, the difference between you and I is that I would go, maybe that is Death.
Oh,
McKean is like, yeah, that's the big difference between you and I. and I do think McKean is kind of right about that in the sense that sometimes it does feel like you have to buy into it if you want to witness a tulpa, right? Especially if your mind is really squarely locked in the mode of science-based, empirical, rational thought. You know, as like your main baseline, like pretty obvious that witnessing a tulpa might need you to require some information. Even the Philip experiment says that it's the information came from the subconscious of the people, right? But what about in cases where you're not looking for anything specific at all? Like even Lamont Cranston, the Shadow, only showed up because people already thought that 12 Gay Street was haunted because of Frank and whatever. They had experienced all kinds of haunting type stuff, and not all of it was Lamont Cranston. So when they brought somebody there and they started to become this haunted place, that's when they start to see this tulpa that was already there, theoretically, right? So I made extra sure to request evidence of specific scenarios where people were not looking for anything specific. Yeah, so Agent Brown came through, and anyway, here's the story.
Is like, okay.
Yeah, good job. Yeah,
hard work. Wow. I like to do my homework. Yeah, I like to put the Chilluminati through their paces.
Yeah, no.
Jesse, what are you talking about? The Chilluminati are real.
Yeah, no,
here's the story of like six different writers of the iconic long-running Vertigo comic book Hellblazer running into the story's main character, John Constantine.
Sorry, I didn't realize I pronounced it wrong all these years.
Listen, I'm also definitely going to mess this up today, but it is Constantine and not Constantine. I know.
It's not how Keanu Reeves said it.
I know they say it other ways in stuff an awful lot, but it is true. It is Constantine. Alan Moore says so, and he made him up in Swamp Thing, so I'm sorry.
Alex, before we continue, Keanu Reeves, perfect casting, or would you have somebody else play him?
I would start with a fucking British person. How about that?
No.
Coleman is like 10
Keanu
times the
wants to make another one, so I say let him. I don't care.
Let him. I don't care. I like that movie, but it's not like a good adaptation of Constantine.
Whoa.
Of Hellblazer.
You're telling me how to fight demons.
Yeah. Shia LaBeouf was in it, too.
Yeah. And by the way, when he lands on the car right at the beginning. Anyway, speaking of Alan Moore, here is an account from Alan Moore in 1993 from Wizard Magazine for Jesse to read. I don't know if you're going to try an Alan Moore voice.
I will not. No,
you shouldn't.
Yeah, good call. That's a very good call.
All right. This is going to come in two pieces because it's a little big, but it's here we go. I'm going to give you the second one. And you're off to the races.
Basically, when I take over something as a writer, I always try to work as closely as I can with the artists on the book. So I immediately did my best to strike up a friendship with Stephen Bissett and John Tuttlebutton. I asked them what they would like to do in Swamp Thing. They both sent me reams of material, things they had always wanted to do in Swamp Thing but never thought they would get away with. I incorporated this into my scheme of things and tried to pin it all together. One of those early notes was they both wanted to do a character that looked like Sting. I think DC is terrified of Sting, that Sting will sue them. Although Sting has seen the character and commented in Rolling Stone that he thought it was great. He was very flattered to have a comic character who looked like him, but DC gets nervous about these things. They start to eradicate all traces of references to the introductions of early Swamp Thing books, to John Constantine's resemblance to Sting. But I can state categorically that the character only exists because Steve and John wanted to do a character that looked like Sting. Having been given the challenge, how could I fit Sting into Swamp Thing? I have an idea that most of the mystics in comics are generally older people, very austere, very proper, very middle class in a lot of ways. They're not all functional on the street. Struck me that it might be interesting for once to do an almost blue-collar warlock. Somebody who was streetwise, working class, and from a different background than the standard run of comic book mystics. Constantine started to grow out of that. One interesting anecdote I should point out is that one day I was in Westminster in London. This was after we had introduced the character, and I was sitting in a sandwich bar. All of a sudden, up the stairs came John Constantine. It wasn't Sting. It was John Constantine. He was wearing the trench coat, a short cut. He didn't even look exactly like Sting. He looked exactly like John Constantine. He looked at me, stared me straight in the eyes, smiled, nodded almost conspiratorially, and then just walked off around the corner to the other part of the snack bar. I sat there and thought I should go around that corner and see if he's really there. Or should I just eat my sandwich and leave? I opted for the latter. I thought it was the safest. I'm not making any claims, anything. I'm just saying that it happened. Strange little story.
Yeah. So he saw him at a sandwich shop in Westminster and he knew it was him. And there's more from Alan Moore because he meet him twice. And so I have a account of his second meeting from 2001, which was written as part of a performance piece called Snakes and Ladders. I'll read that for you right now. The written page becomes too frail a barrier. Things start to tear their way through from the other side, almost as if the realms of waking substance and of fantasy were not two separate worlds at all, but were instead gradations on a smooth continuum. A single stream that trickles in the crystal-littered gutters of Baghdad. The dreams start answering back. Miss Lally waves to Mackin from a tea shop window. Elsewhere in Connecticut, a ghostly form in cloak and hat is seen in the abandoned house once owned by stage magician Walter Gibson, who, as Maxwell Grant, spent several million words there writing the adventures of pulp mystery man, The Shadow, with his cloak, with his slouch hat. Sat at a sandwich bar in Westminster, I meet the sharp South London wide boy occultist that I'd created some years previously for a US comic book. He looks at me. He nods and smiles and walks away. Years later, in another place, he steps out from the dark and speaks to me. He whispers, I'll tell you the ultimate secret of magic. Any cunt could do it. There is one last account by Alan Moore of meeting John Constantine where he kind of expands upon the second sighting a little bit. And he had been practicing, he'd been doing a magic ritual upstairs with his, like, the people he practices magic with. And this is what happened.
Classic next. People.
Yeah.
Am I reading this?
Yes.
I just stepped out of the room and popped downstairs to make some tea. And I was just passing through the kitchen when all of a sudden in the darkness on the left side of my head, it's very difficult to describe this, but it was clearly that somebody had struck a match in the darkness. And this lit up the face of John Constantine in the sudden halo of the match flare. And he, in a typically amusing way, told me the ultimate secret of magic very memorably in one very short 5-word sentence and then blew the match out and vanished.
Yeah. So that's Alan Moore's interactions with John Constantine.
Which is also Grant Morrison's lesson in magic is that it's easy. Anybody can do it. Stop being a bitch.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's also Jamie Delano, who was like the first writer of Hellblazer, kind of like made Hellblazer a popular comic book. This is him from 1997. He was interviewed by Australian horror magazine Blood Songs in issue 8. So this is a quote from Jamie Delano for Jesse to read.
I started writing it and he gradually came. Well, he quickly came to life and started walking and talking, saying a lot of things I would have been saying at the time or thinking at the time. And it was set in the real 1980s environment. We had the real prime minister, the real elections going on, real shit that was happening in the country, trying to capture all those moods. When Alan Moore was writing John Constantine, he met him, saw him in the cafe in Westminster. When I was writing him, I walked past him outside the British Museum in Bloomsbury. I didn't realize I'd walked past him until I'd gone 50 yards down the road. I would look around, and he was just vanishing around the corner. So yeah, it was all very real and immediate, and the stuff I was trying to make stories out of was real and immediate. We had demons and shit like that, but they were mainly allegorical, comic book convention type stuff to a certain degree. Lately, I've moved away a lot more from that.
Yeah. So Jamie Delano sees him in the street. Also a sort of just strange sense that you saw him and then you look and it's him and he's gone, right?
Yeah.
I have an account from Peter Milligan and Brian Azzarello meeting Constantine as told to Abraham Reisman for Vulture magazine in 2014. This is for Mathis to read.
Peter Milligan saw Constantine at a party around 2009 and rushed after him, only to find he'd disappeared. Brian Azzarello saw him at a Chicago bar in the early aughts, but avoided him. The thing is about John is the last thing you'd want to be is his friend, he told me.
That's true. All of John's friends die. Paul Jenkins, also another writer of John Constantine, tweeted in reply to a screen cap of the in real life section of John Constantine's Wikipedia page. He wrote this tweet.
You're missing two people, myself and Rick Veitch. I ran into him on the platform at East Croydon station on my way to a Palace match.
Yeah. So also Paul Jenkins and Rick Veitch have seen him. All people who've worked on Constantine, all have seen Constantine in real life. Not every single person that's worked on it, but a lot of them. For this last one, just to mess with everybody's heads a little bit for fun, here's John Constantine with an account of meeting Alan Moore in a pub in 1997 from Hellblazer number 120, the 10th anniversary issue by Paul Jenkins. And we'll have Jesse
read
this.
That's funny.
God damn you. Oh, mommy, mammy, moo. Me. All right. Look, I realize it's a bit naff feeling sorry for yourself after a few pints. But it's the place, ain't it? Sometimes
I feel like I live in here. You see him over there? Old mate of mine from before I was even a player. I introduced me to a lot of people, he did, back when I was nobody. But him, he was full of clever bloody ideas. He got me involved in a lot of mad shit. Next thing I know, I'm knee-deep in Sod and Cabbage Club. My life's been a bloody mess ever since. Ah, well, those were the days, eh? We've dropped out of touch a bit since then. I mean, we run into each other from time to time, like, but nothing much of consequence. Still, you know, cheers, man.
And strangely, like, if you look in Hellblazer 120, there's actually footage of them meeting, and it's illustrated in full color. It's pretty crazy. You can actually see him.
That's cute. That's
fun. Yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the story of John Constantine in real life. But the Chilluminati were not yet content, because it is not only comic books that we are here to talk about today. And if tulpas really are tangible things that are literally out there, and not just various writers and magicians' interpretations of their respective creative or ritualistic processes, logically, there should also be accounts of these things occurring in places where their creators have never been, to people who don't even know about them, right? So Agent Brown found me one of those two. This comes from Monique Jones from Staffordshire, recounting an event that occurred to her in 2012 in a letter which was published in the May 2016 issue of 40 and Times. That's number 340. And Jesse, I'm going to have you read this one also. This one is a little long, so let me see where it stops, and then I'll give you the rest.
Around 4 p.m. one November afternoon, I was taking me dog Bryn for his walk. I live in a semi-rural location, so surrounded by fields with winding paths. About halfway down one of those paths, my little dog became agitated and pulled on his lead. It was almost dark by this time, very misty and quiet. As I carried on along the path, I became increasingly uncomfortable, as though I were not alone. I began to look around and listen for any other walker. Lots of people walked their dogs along this path, but I couldn't see or hear anyone. I began to feel uneasy and wanted to stop back when suddenly, standing across the path, was a very tall bald man dressed in all black with long arms dangling at his side and no facial features. Bryn became quiet and stopped pulling. I remember thinking his arms looked far too long for a person. Apart from the head, he looked as if he were dressed in a wetsuit. I just stood there watching him as he watched me. Then he started to spin, and as he did, his arms rose up. I couldn't believe what I was saying, but I knew I had to get away. I turned around and started to run, pulling Bryn beside me. He was barking loudly now, and he didn't want to come with me. I stopped briefly and turned around to check what was happening behind me. The man had vanished. He couldn't have run away, as I would have seen him somewhere in the field. But he was nowhere in sight. I carried on running up the path and suddenly at the field gate stopped at the field gate and looked behind again. No sign of anyone or anything. I carried on home, which only 1 minute from the field, closed the door behind me and stood in disbelief in the hallway. What on earth had I just witnessed out there? Later that same evening, I spoke to my daughter Natalie, who was living in Japan at the time. As we were chatting, I mentioned my experience. It was preying heavily on my mind. She told me to check out Slender Man on the internet, a character I never heard of. When I did, I was shocked as Slender Man looked just like the figure I'd see in the field. I know it's supposed to be a myth, and what I saw that afternoon was real and solid and right in front of me. It's now 4 years later since that happened. I'm still wary of that path, and I rarely have walked down it.
James Corden, everybody.
Thank you.
She saw Slender Man before knowing who he was. And to expand on that idea a little bit, here's an excerpt from my favorite new website, anomalyinfo.com. about the letter, which was published in July 2019 and reads, "The internet legend of the Slender Man was first created in June 2009, and within just a few days, the group started to promote the character as if real, an effort that was supported in a number of ways until June 2014, when two girls in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, USA, tried to murder a third girl in an attempt to summon the Slender Man, after which the main creators of the legend had to make full statements regarding the fictional nature of the character. Realistically, there was plenty of evidence and statements about the character not being real all along, but some people just wanted to believe. As reported, Jones's strange encounter would have occurred in the period between the character's creation and the eventual public exposé. And because she didn't report the matter until well after June 2014, the creators of the legend, during the active period of its promotion, would not have known of her strange encounter with their fictional character. Had Jones heard of the encounter, then we could blame her imagination. And while a person could have dressed up as the Slender Man to frighten her, this doesn't explain how such a person could appear or vanish so completely with no cover in a field. Of course, it's also possible that Jones's story is just another late attempt to convince people that the Slender Man has become real. But then why not report it as a more recent encounter if so? Simply put, if Jones is telling the truth, then however it happened, her experience was quite unique. But emphasis is on the word if. So, yeah. Like, if she was trying to make a fake story, she could have changed some details and made it more believable, but she didn't. And
sure,
she may have seen a Slender Man tulpa somewhere where she didn't know what Slender Man was or that it existed. Right?
Right.
That's kind of interesting. And then beyond just tulpas appearing to random strangers, what about cases of random strangers not realizing that they themselves were tulpas? Like the way in which Colombian author Hector Abad Faciolince finally met his character Bernardo Davanzati. This one is for Mathis to read, and I'm going to have to give it to him in two pieces.
You tended to change your email account over the years, Hotmail, Yahoo, or UN here in Colombia, until Gmail absorbed it all and you forget some of the stories left behind in the old addresses. They become like the locations of former homes, falling into decay over the years or decades before they disappear. Indeed, they become inaccessible and prevented reconstruction with bits of the past that exist either exactly in the correspondence or vaguely and transformed in one's memory. It is for these email changes that I cannot precisely rebuild the start of my story with a compatriot who has been living in Copenhagen for nearly 50 years now, without ever returning home to Colombia, and who sent me an email at the start of the millennium to state something like, quote, "You do not know it, but Davanzati exists. I am Bernardo Davanzati." Davanzati is the protagonist of one of my novels, Basura, published in Spain in 2000. Its main character is an old man who wrote a couple of books nobody read and who now lives alone and writes compulsively, though for nobody, as he tosses out everything he writes. I've often received emails from a female reader saying something like, "I really identified with the book," or another one thanks me by saying, your novel clearly states something I have long believed. But it is rare to receive a message by an unknown person who insists they are one of my characters. And that happened to me more than 15 years ago with a message sent by the most unusual of correspondents, actually named Hernando Cardona. As best as I recall, I was initially cordial and discreet with him, though I imagine almost certainly reticent. There are too many crazes in the world, and you cannot correspond with every deranged individual who sends you an email. There is something in this work that attracts the attention of the disturbed, the way church spires attract lightning. But this Davanzati doppelganger wrote very well, and he gradually gave me arguments and autobiographical data to confirm his extraordinary resemblance to my fictional character. My sense of curiosity and bemusement peaked when Cardona informed me that as his daily language was Danish, he had translated Basura into that language so some of his female friends could read his life story, not as fragments revealed in conversations, but just as it was. About 10 years ago, Hernando Davanzati let me know he had finished translating Basura, and many of his friends had duly read his life story, which made him feel better. Now there is something in the lives of certain characters that even their authors do not entirely know. In the life of Davanzati, there are certain secrets that are difficult for me to disentangle, obscure episodes from his professional past, drug trafficking or corruption or guerrilla activity, question mark. Unspeakable events of his private life, a spurned child or a devastating love affair, and many dispersed writings impossible to find, which is why I dreamed for years of going to Copenhagen to seek out Cardona. I wanted to meet Bernardo Devanzati, yet every time I suggested it, Cardona discouraged me. Was it all a lie then? His existence, similarity in the translation? 10 years ago, without telling him, I went to Copenhagen for another reason. The first thing I did after arriving was go to the address I had for Cardona. I rang the bell and then I had no doubt it was him, and he recognized me. We went to visit the tomb of Hans Christian Andersen and then had lunch. Now I know my character's secret past. Bernardo Devanzati exists in reality and cannot be anyone other than Hernando Cardona.
Imagine how weird that would fucking be.
So it's like the dude lived the same life, he just had a different name.
Yeah. Enough that he actually translated the entire book.
And looks exactly like him, apparently, according to the author.
And is him. He recognized him and was him.
It's crazy.
And he found him. And he found him by reading the book and realizing, holy shit, this guy wrote a book about me. Pretty interesting stuff. I don't know.
It's interesting.
Like, yeah. I'm trying to come at this concept from a lot of different ways so that I activate it for everybody's brain possible, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're trying to frame this in different perspectives so that people understand what you're getting at. Yeah.
And so finally for you today, I have a piece that I'm going to read myself from another Philip, Philip K. Dick, the author of so many crazy influential science fiction stories like Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was adapted into Blade Runner, and A Scanner Darkly, which was a movie, and Ubik, I think, which was adapted into Vanilla Sky, and We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, which was adapted into Total Recall, and fucking The Minority Report, which was adapted into Minority Report. And that's not even like half of them, actually. He's actually crazy, but he also kind of went nuts by the end of his life. But this piece comes from a speech he wrote in 1978. He went to my college and was like friends with all the English staff there like a lot before I went there. And so all his works are at my college. So I've always felt very fascinated by this guy, but this piece comes from a speech he wrote in 1978 called How to Build a Universe That Doesn't Fall Apart 2 days Later. It's not the whole speech, but this is just a piece from it. The basic tool for the manipulation of reality is the manipulation of words. If you can control the meaning of words, you can control the people who must use the words. George Orwell made this clear in his novel, 1984. But another way to control the minds of people is to control their perceptions. If you can get them to see the world as you do, they will think as you do. Comprehension follows perception. How do you get them to see the reality you see? After all, it is only one reality out of many. Images are a basic constituent, pictures. This is why the power of TV to influence young minds is so staggeringly vast. Words and pictures are synchronized. The possibility of total control of the viewer exists, especially the young viewer. TV viewing is a kind of sleep learning. An EEG of a person watching TV shows that after about half an hour, the brain decides that nothing is happening and it goes into a hypnoidal twilight state, emitting alpha waves. This is because there is such little eye motion. In addition, much of the information is graphic and therefore passes into the right hemisphere of the brain rather than being processed by the left, where the conscious personality is located. Recent experiments indicate that much of what we see on the TV screen is received on a subliminal basis. We only imagine that we consciously see what is there. The bulk of the messages elude our attention. Literally, after a few hours of TV watching, we do not know what we have seen. Our memories are spurious, like our memories of dreams. The blanks are filled in retrospectively and falsified. We have participated unknowingly in the creation of a spurious reality, and then we have obligingly fed it to ourselves. We have colluded in our own doom. And I say this as a professional fiction writer, the producers, scriptwriters, and directors who create these video audio worlds do not know how much of their content is true. In other words, they are victims of their own product along with us. Speaking for myself, I do not know how much of my writing is true or which parts, if any, are true. This is a potentially lethal situation. We have fiction mimicking truth and truth mimicking fiction. We have a dangerous overlap, a dangerous blur. In all probability, it is not deliberate. In fact, that is part of the problem. You cannot legislate an author into correctly labeling his product like a can of pudding whose ingredients are listed on the label. You cannot compel him to declare what part is true and what isn't if he himself does not know. It is an eerie experience to write something into a novel believing it is pure fiction and to learn later on, perhaps years later, that it is true. I would like to give you an example. It is something that I do not understand. Perhaps you can come up with a theory. I can't. In 1970, I wrote a novel called Flow My Tears, the policeman said. One of the characters is a 19-year-old girl named Kathy. Her husband's name is Jack. Kathy appears to work for the criminal underground, but later, as we read deeper into the novel, we discover that actually, she's working for the police. She has a relationship going on with a police inspector. The character is pure fiction. Or at least I thought it was. Anyway, on Christmas Day of 1970, I met a girl named Kathy. This was after I had finished the novel, you understand. She was 19 years old. Her boyfriend was named Jack. I soon learned that Kathy was a drug dealer. I spent months trying to get her to give up dealing drugs. I kept warning her again and again that she would get caught. Then, one evening, as we were entering a restaurant together, Kathy stopped short and said, "I can't go in." Seated in the restaurant was a police inspector whom I knew. "I have to tell you the truth," Kathy said. "I have a relationship with him." Certainly, these are odd coincidences. Perhaps I have precognition. But the mystery becomes even more perplexing. The next stage totally baffles me. It has for 4 years. In 1974, the novel was published by Doubleday. One afternoon, I was talking to my priest. I am an Episcopalian. And I happened to mention to him an important scene near the end of the novel in which the character Felix Buckman meets a black stranger at an all-night gas station and they begin to talk. As I described the scene in more and more detail, my priest became progressively more agitated. At last, he said, "That is a scene from the book of Acts from the Bible. In Acts, the person who meets the black man on the road is named Philip, your name." Father Roche was so upset by the resemblance that he could not even locate the scene in the Bible. "Read Acts," he instructed me, "and you'll agree. It's the same down to specific details." I went home and read the scene in Acts. Yes, Father Rash was right. The scene in my novel was an obvious retelling of the scene in Acts. And I had never read Acts, I must admit. But again, the puzzle became deeper. In Acts, the high Roman official who arrests and interrogates St. Paul is named Felix, the same name as my character. And my character, Felix Buckman, is a high-ranking police general. In fact, in my novel, he holds the same office as Felix in the Book of Acts, the final authority. There is a conversation in my novel which very closely resembles a conversation between Felix and Paul. Well, I decided to try for any further resemblances. The main character in my novel is named Jason. I got an index to the Bible and looked to see if anyone named Jason appears anywhere in the Bible. I couldn't remember any. Well, a man named Jason appears once and only once in the Bible, and it is in the Book of Acts. And, as if to plague me further with coincidences, in my novel, Jason is fleeing from the authorities and takes refuge in a person's house. And in Acts, the man named Jason shelters a fugitive from the law in his house. An exact inversion of the situation in my novel, as if the mysterious spirit responsible for all this was having a sort of laugh about the whole thing. Felix, Jason, and the meeting on the road with the black man who is a complete stranger. In Acts, the disciple Philip baptizes the man, who then goes away rejoicing. In my novel, Felix Buckman reaches out to the black stranger for emotional support because Felix Buckman's sister has just died, and he's falling apart psychologically. The black man stirs up Buckman's spirits, and although Buckman does not go away rejoicing, at least his tears have stopped falling. He had been flying home, weeping over the death of his sister, and had to reach out to someone, anyone, even a total stranger. It is an encounter between two strangers on the road which changes the life of one of them, both in my novel and in Acts. And one final quirk by the mysterious spirit at work, the name Felix is the Latin word for happy, which I did not know when I wrote the novel. Careful study of my novel shows that for reasons which I cannot even begin to explain, I had managed to retell several of the basic incidents from a particular book of the Bible and even had the right names. What could explain this? That was 4 years ago that I discovered all this. For 4 years, I've tried to come up with a theory, and I have not. I doubt if I ever will. But the mystery had not ended there as I had imagined. 2 months ago, I was walking up to the mailbox late at night to mail off a letter and also to enjoy the sight of St. Joseph Church, which sits opposite my apartment building. I noticed a man loitering suspiciously by a parked car. It looked as if he was attempting to steal the car or maybe something from it. As I returned to the mailbox, the man hid behind a tree. On impulse, I walked up to him and asked, "Is anything the matter?" "I'm out of gas," the man said, "and I have no money." Incredibly, because I have never done this before, I got out my wallet, took all the money from it, and handed the money to him. He then shook hands with me and asked where I lived so that he could later pay the money back. I returned to my apartment, and then I realized that the money would do him no good since there was no gas station within walking distance, so I returned in my car. The man had a metal gas can in the trunk of his car, and together we drove in my car to an all-night gas station. Soon we were standing there, two strangers, as the pump jockey filled the metal gas can. Suddenly, I realized that this was the scene in my novel, the novel written 8 years before. The all-night gas station was exactly as I had envisioned it in my inner eye when I wrote the scene, the glaring white light, the pump jockey. And now I saw something which I had not seen before, which I editorially doubt. The stranger, who I was helping, was black. We drove back to his stalled car with the gas, shook hands, and then I returned to my apartment building. I never saw him again. He could not pay me back because I had not told him which of the many apartments was mine or what my name was. I was terribly shaken up by this experience. I had literally lived out a scene completely as it appeared in my novel, which is to say, I had lived out a sort of replica of the scene in Acts where Philip encounters the black man on the road. What can explain all this? The answer I have come up with may or may not be correct, but it is the only answer I have. It has to do with me. My theory is this. In some certain important sense, time is not real. Or perhaps it is real, but not as we experience it to be or imagine it to be. I had the acute, overwhelming certitude, and still have, that despite all the change we see, a specific permanent landscape underlies the world of change. And that this invisible underlying landscape is that of the Bible. It specifically is the period immediately following the death and resurrection of Christ. It is, in other words, the time period of the book of Acts. Parmenides would be proud of me. I have gazed at a constantly changing world and declared that underneath it lies the eternal, the unchanging, the absolutely real. But how has this come about? If the real time is circa AD 50, then why do we see AD 1978? And if we really are living in the Roman Empire, somewhere in Syria, why do we see the United States? During the Middle Ages, a curious theory arose, which I will now present to you for what it is worth. It is the theory that the evil one, Satan, is the ape of God, that he creates spurious imitations of creation, of God's authentic creation, and then interpolates them for that authentic creation. Does this odd theory help explain my experience? Are we to believe that we are occluded, that we are deceived, that it is not 1978 but AD 50, and Satan has spun a counterfeit reality to wither our faith in the return of Christ? What do you guys think about that?
He was so close. He was so close. And when he was saying time isn't real, I'm like, yeah, there's something there about the, you know, everything happens in the now of now, and there's only now. We just perceive linear time, and maybe just patterns on an information level reveal themselves over and over again.
That's where I thought he was going. Yeah.
But then he was like, God, devil, Satan, trickery. I figured it
admittedly,
out.
Great idea for like a novel or a series of stories or something where it's like, hey, religious authors. Less left behind, more of this. Yeah. I like the idea of like the devil is messing with humanity has not actually left AD 50. We are all still there and everything has been a delusion since like that. Do that. That's great. That's fascinating. Yeah, that's
fun. It's no accident that he drew a line between Satan and the television, right?
I mean, like, Jim Carrey did that in the Batman movie. So like, you know,
yeah, no, exactly. That's why that movie's a masterpiece. But I think I think what he says is the most accurate to like what, like other than the part where he like left turns like straight into like literal religious interpretation. Like, I think he's right about like the idea that all this stuff is just kind of like not real anyway. Like, if we're talking about, let's just take Satan out of the equation, right? We're talking about consensus reality, right? Which is like a Venn diagram that everybody's part of, but like not, it's not a circle.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I don't know whether or not it's meant to be deceitful. I will leave to somebody other than me to explain, but you know, I do think that there's something about that shape that really explains a lot of what we feel about making things come out of our minds into reality as people,
yeah,
and humans, and what that means for us. but yeah, for further reading on tulpas, there's a great Tumblr called Sophie in Wonderland, which you can follow from the description to see a nice varied collection of viewpoints on the topic by various different experts and eyewitnesses from all different angles, where you're not even talking about tulpas sometimes and you're talking about it from scientific. It's just a great resource. And also, I must admit, I have some optional but really awesome homework for you out there listening to try. And it's very simple, also very open-ended.
I like that.
And it's just this. Please write poems, short stories, and comics about our own little tulpa, the Boston Baked Bean Boy, for the next couple months. Again, the Boston Baked Bean Boy is a little bean boy who loves weed, but he only smokes legal weed. Okay?
Yeah. And he's just a little tiny bean. He's just a little bit of bean.
Legal nugs.
Yeah,
legal
nugs. Post him on the Reddit, collaborate, and we'll see if, thanks to our overwhelming numbers and you guys reading each other's stuff on the Reddit, we can get a real tangible thought form of the little bastard.
Are you trying to create a real bean boy?
Yes. Yes.
All right. By the way, hey, heads up, everyone. Little Bean Boy won't ask you to do crazy stuff.
No. Yeah.
Only buy him legal nugs. That's it. He wants nothing else.
He literally won't take, he won't take legal nugs.
No, he's a law-abiding here.
He's a law-abiding
Bean Boy.
Little Bean Boy.
He's a law-abiding bean. Yeah.
Yeah.
And with that, I believe I'm going to declare that this months-long, specifically intertextual miniseries on chaos magic that almost came into existence on its own without us really planning it or fully meaning to has finally come to an end. And you know what? The only thing I have left to say about it is, guess the spell worked. Get us out of here, Mathis.
Thank you so much for listening. We're off to do a minisode at patreon.com/IlluminatiPod, where Jesse has something he's fucking thrilled to read.
Yeah,
us, so
I'm really excited.
Wait.
It's going to be cool.
I can't wait. We'll see you there. Thank you guys so much again. We'll see you next week. Goodbye.
Blah, blah, blah.
Anyway, me and my wife were sitting outside indulging on our porch one night, enjoying ourselves. I needed to go to the bathroom, so I stepped back inside, and after a few moments, I hear my wife go, "Holy shit, get out here." So I quickly dash back outside, where she's looking up at the sky in awe. I look up too.